need to understand and communicate, for instance, about the greatest moral issue of our time, global warming. The ecology is a system operating via systemic causation. Without an everyday concept of systemic causation, global warming cannot be properly comprehended. In other words, without the systemic causation frame, the oft-repeated facts about global warming cannot make sense. With only the direct causation frame, the systemic causation facts of global warming are ignored. The old frame stays, and the facts that don't fit it cannot be comprehended. The structure of systemic causation. Systemic causation has a structure, four possible elements that can exist alone or in combination. Driving a complex systemic problem, there can be one, two, three, or all four of these elements in play. Here is how they might be explained in conversation about global warming. A network of direct causes. 1. Global warming heats the Pacific Ocean. That means that the water molecules in the ocean get more active, move with more energy, evaporate more, and move in the air with more energy. 2. Winds in the high atmosphere over the ocean blow from southwest to northeast, blowing the larger amounts of high-energy moisture over the pole. 3. In winter, the moisture turns to snow and comes down over the east coast as a huge blizzard. Thus, global warming can systemically cause major blizzards. Feedback loops. 1. The Arctic ice pack reflects light and heat. 2. As the Earth's atmosphere heats up, the Arctic ice pack melts and gets smaller. 3. The smaller amount of Arctic ice reflects less light and heat, and more heat stays in the atmosphere. 4. The atmosphere gets warmer. 5. The feedback loop. Even more Arctic ice melts, even less heat is reflected, even more heat stays, even more ice melts, and on and on. Multiple causes. Because of the interaction between the polar vortex and the jet stream, parts of the vortex move south into central North America, causing abnormal freezing temperatures as far south as Oklahoma and Georgia. Probabilistic causation. Many weather phenomena are probabilistic. What is caused is a probability distribution. Although you can't predict whether a flipped coin will come down heads or tails, you can predict that over the course of a large number of flips, almost exactly 50% will come down heads and another 50% tails. Yes, global warming systemically caused freezes in the American South. Yes, global warming systemically caused Hurricane Sandy, and the Midwest droughts and the fires in Colorado and Texas, as well as other extreme weather disasters around the world. Let's say it out loud. It was causation, systemic causation. Network causes, feedback loops, multiple causes, all acting probabilistically as part of the global weather system, have been systemically causing weather disasters. Yes, systemically causing untold human harm and billions, if not trillions, of dollars in damage. Systemic causation is familiar. Smoking is a systemic cause of lung cancer. HIV is a systemic cause of AIDS. Working in coal mines is a systemic cause of black lung disease. Driving while drunk is a systemic cause of auto accidents. Sex without contraception is a systemic cause of unwanted pregnancies, which are a systemic cause of abortions. Systemic causation, because it is less obvious than direct causation, is more important to understand. A systemic cause may be one of a number of multiple causes. It may require some special conditions. It may be indirect, working through a network of more direct causes. It may be probabilistic, occurring with a significantly high probability. It may require a feedback mechanism. In general, causation in ecosystems, biological systems, economic systems, and social systems tends not to be direct, but is no less causal. And because it is not direct causation, it requires all the greater attention if it is to be understood and its negative effects controlled. Above all, it requires a name, systemic causation. The precise details of Hurricane Sandy could not have been predicted in advance any more than when or whether a smoker develops lung cancer, or sex without contraception yields an unwanted pregnancy, or a drunk driver has an accident. But systemic causation is nonetheless causal. Semantics matter. Because the word cause is commonly taken to mean direct cause, climate scientists, trying to be precise, have too often shied away from attributing causation of a particular hurricane, drought, or fire to global warming. Lacking a concept, a frame, and language for systemic causation, climate scientists have made the dreadful communicative mistake of retreating to weasel words. Consider this quote from Perception of Climate Change by James Hansen, Makiko Sato, and Rito Rudy, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. We can state with a high degree of confidence that extreme anomalies such as those in Texas and Oklahoma in 2011 and Moscow in 2010 were a consequence of global warming because their likelihood in the absence of global warming was exceedingly small. The crucial words here are high degree of confidence, anomalies, consequence, likelihood, absence, and exceedingly small. Scientific weasel words. The power of the bald truth, namely causation, is lost. This is no small matter. The fate of the earth is at stake. The science is excellent. The scientist's ability to communicate is lacking. Without the words, the idea cannot even be expressed. And without an understanding of systemic causation, we cannot understand what is hitting us. Global warming is real, and it is here. It is causing, yes, causing, death, destruction, and vast economic loss. And the causal effects are getting greater with time. We cannot merely adapt to it. The costs are incalculable. What we are facing is huge. Each day, the amount of extra energy accumulating via the heating of the Earth is the equivalent of 400,000 Hiroshima atomic bombs. Each day. What journalists can do. Because systemic causation has mostly gone unframed and unnamed, journalists have previously been at a loss and have been driven to resort to inadequate and misleading metaphors. Charles Petit, writing in the Night Science Journalism Tracker of January 7, 1914, gives a list of such metaphors. Here are some buttes. A weaker polar vortex moving around the Arctic like a slowly spinning top, eventually falling over and blowing open the door to the Arctic freezer. This big slug of deadly cryosphere air slipped its North Pole moorings, marauded across Canada, and swept through the eastern U.S. When the winds weaken, the vortex can begin to wobble like a drunk on his fourth martini. In this case, nearly the entire polar vortex has tumbled southward. Responsible journalists can do better. Responsible journalists need to discuss systemic causation. Certainly when discussing global warming and its climate effects, and also when discussing other systemic effects, such as those of fracking, the privatization of education, the decline of unions, and so on. Responsible journalists also need to discuss a devastating systemic effect on our economics, recently discovered but not brought into public discourse by the press, the systemic effect of the relationship between productive wealth and reinvestment wealth. The version of systemic causation just discussed is designed to fit global warming phenomena. In addition, there are other forms of systemic causation that we will be discussing, for example, in the study of economics. But for our purposes in this book, the most important form of systemic causation concerns the brain itself. The phenomenon of reflexivity is a form of systemic causation. And the relationship between our politics and the concept of personhood is one of the hardest cases of systemic causation to get across to the public, especially to political pundits, policymakers, strategists, pollsters, and other political professionals. Chapter 5. Politics and Personhood. Each of us has a sense of personal identity, your sense of who you are as a person. Central to that personal identity is a moral sense, a sense of what is right and wrong, what justifies our actions. That moral sense, like all that we believe and understand, is physical, built into the neural circuitry of our brains. If that changes, if the circuitry characterizing our moral sense changes, it changes our personhood. That is, it changes the kind of people we are, what we think is right and how we act. We have seen that all politics is moral since political policies are assumed to be right, not wrong or irrelevant. Our political divisions come down to moral divisions, characterized in our brains by very different brain circuitry. We've seen that the major moral divisions in our politics derive from two opposed models of the family, a progressive, nurturant parent morality, and a conservative, strict father morality. That is no accident, since your family life has a profound effect on how you understand yourself as a person. The effect of family life is complex, and peers have an effect as well. One result of that is biconceptualism. Biconceptuals have both kinds of moral circuitry in their brain, mutually inhibiting each other and applying to different issues person by person. There is no middle, no morally based political ideology common to all moderates. Regardless of whether you are progressive, conservative, or biconceptual, though, your morality, your sense of what a person should be and do, is deeply connected to the way your brain triggers emotions and determines whether you feel good or bad in certain situations and about certain ideas. It is worth understanding why. The science behind empathy and morality. One of the great discoveries of neuroscience is the mirror neuron system. Simply put, that system operates in our brains and gives us the capacity to connect with others, to know and even feel what they feel, and to connect with the natural world. It is the heart of our capacity for empathy. From emotion research, we know that certain emotions correlate with certain actions in our own bodies, in facial muscles, in posture, and so on. When we feel happy, for instance, our facial muscles are prompted to produce a smile, as opposed to a frowning or a baring of the teeth. We also know that the physical cues that broadcast emotion in others will usually trigger in an observer the same brain response that would accompany those physical cues of the same emotion in ourselves. That is why we can usually tell if someone else is happy or sad, or angry or bored, and why a smile is often unconsciously greeted with a smile or a yawn with a yawn. All this is thanks to the mirror neuron system, which has circuitry connecting the brain's action centers and perception centers. As a consequence, what you see others doing is neurally paired with brain activity that could control your own actions. Muscles are activated by firing neurons, and many of the same neurons are firing whether you are performing an action or whether you are seeing someone else performing the same action. This mirroring allows you to see the musculature tied to the emotions of others, and sense in your brain what the same musculature would be like in your body, and hence the same emotions in yourself. In short, it allows you to feel the emotions of others. That is what empathy is about. But this effect has further repercussions in the brain. Neuroscientists have discovered a brain overlap, too, between imagining and doing. Many of the same neural regions are activated when we form mental images as when we actually see. The same holds true for whether we imagine moving or are actually moving. That means we have the capacity to empathize not only with someone present, but also with someone we can imagine, remember, read about, dream about, and so on. That is why we can be deeply moved by a novel or a movie or even a newspaper story. Neuroscientists have also shown that when someone is in love and they see their loved one in pain, the pain center in their own brain is activated. Emotional pain is real. Sounds simple, but there are some twists to the story, some neural complications that affect how we ultimately respond to what we see, hear, and imagine. The prefrontal cortex has regions particularly active during the exercise of judgment. These regions contain neurons that are active when we are performing some particular action and less active when we see someone else performing the same action. It is hypothesized that this gives us the capacity to modulate our empathy, to lessen it or turn it off in certain cases. The mirror neuron system thus connects us emotionally to others, but can, in certain cases, also distance us emotionally from others. The prefrontal cortex is active in another neural system, too, one that I'll call the well-being-ill-being system. This is the system that releases certain hormones in your brain when you have experiences that make you feel good, and releases others when experiences make you feel bad. In essence, this system regulates whether you have a sense of well-being or ill-being at any given time. It is also the system that presumably is involved in making judgments on the basis of your imagination of what will or won't bring you well-being. The well-being system and the empathy system can interact in complex ways. Some people feel satisfaction both when they are personally satisfied and when those they empathize with feel a sense of well-being. Other people do not have the two systems connected in that way. 1. They have the well-being system overriding the empathy system, with their interests overriding the cares and interests of others. Or, 2, they can have a complex interaction in which they maintain their own well-being and balance it with contributing to the well-being of others. Or, 3, they may be self-sacrificing, always placing the well-being of others ahead of their own well-being. Or, 4, they may be part of an in-group and may place their well-being and that of the in-group members first, without empathizing at all with out-group members. This can vary depending on what counts as a given person's in-group. Since morality is about well-being, your own and that of others, these four alternatives define different moral attitudes. Can the mirror neuron system be affected by inborn factors? Apparently, yes. With certain forms of autism, empathy is lessened or largely absent. In psychopaths, empathy is controlled. Psychopaths can sense what someone else is feeling, not be affected themselves, and then manipulate the other for their own benefit or enjoyment. Can the mirror system be affected by how one is raised, by one's family life and peer relations? Does one's political morality correlate with one's capacity for empathy? That is, with the operation of the mirror neuron and well-being systems. That is being investigated, and preliminary results suggest there is a difference between extreme progressives and extreme conservatives, with extreme conservatives showing less activation in their empathy system. Since all thoughts and feelings are physical, a matter of brain circuitry, It is not surprising that moral sensibility should be constituted by physical brain structures like those we have just been discussing. These brain structures form the neural basis not only of your own moral sensibilities, but also your views on what an ideal person ought to be. The ideal person. What should an ideal person be like? Conservatives and progressives have largely opposite views, given their different views of morality. Biconceptuals have different views as well, depending on how their moral views are divided up. Biconceptuals who are largely conservative will tend to have a conservative view of what people should be like, and biconceptuals who are largely progressive will tend to have a progressive view of what people should be like. Or biconceptuals that are less extreme may believe that an ideal person is biconceptual in the same way they are, with the same distribution of conservative and progressive views. The progressive, nurturant parent moral system maintains a delicate balance between the empathy and the personal well-being systems. At its core is empathy for others and the responsibility to act on that empathy, but it is modulated by the proviso that you can't take care of anyone else if you're not taking care of yourself. That is, it centers on empathy and includes both personal and social responsibility. The conservative moral system centers on the well-being system, on personal responsibility alone, on serving your own interests without depending on the empathy of others to take care of you and without having empathy and responsibility for others. There are nuances, but this gets at the heart of the difference. Empathy versus sympathy. Empathy and sympathy both involve the capacity to know what others are feeling. But unlike empathy, sympathy involves distancing, overriding personal emotional feeling. Someone who is sympathetic may well act to relieve the pain of others but not feel the pain themselves. The word compassion can be used for either empathy or sympathy, depending on who is using the word. For example, George W. Bush, in first announcing his run for the presidency, called himself a compassionate conservative, citing the book by Marvin Alasky, The Tragedy of American Compassion. Alasky and Bush's take on compassion and conservatism point to a central difference between progressives and conservatives. Progressives tend to believe that society as a whole has a responsibility to aid those in real material need, and that the government should be a major instrument, with support from taxes. Conservatives tend to prefer charity, delivered through non-governmental organizations, and tend to believe that real help for most people in material need is a refusal of aid, to give them an incentive to help themselves. Hence the conservative motto, "It is better to teach someone to fish than to give him a fish to eat." Incidentally, charity for the deserving few costs a lot less than taxes to provide resources for the benefit of all. This dichotomy leads to two very different ideas of what an ideal person should be like, and how our politics should be arranged to produce a version of the ideal person with the right moral system, whether purely conservative, purely progressive, or the right combination of the two. Reflexivity and personhood. At this point, we have to ask the reflexivity question for personhood. Can linguistic framing change the kind of person someone is? The answer seems to be yes, though possibly not in extreme cases. And, of course, it may depend on age and circumstances, but such changes do appear to have happened over the years, so far as I can tell, mostly with biconceptuals. Extreme conservatives, estimated at about 25 to 30% of the U.S. population, it appears, cannot be changed by reframing and setting up an effective communication system that operates full-time, not just at elections. Yes, this means that some people cannot be reached, an inaccurate progressive metaphor, or woken up, another inaccurate progressive metaphor. Consider the moderate progressive who is partly conservative. She hears conservative language and conservative arguments over and over, day after day, for years, in the media or with friends or both. The conservative language will activate the conservative moral system, making it a bit stronger every time the language is heard. As the conservative circuitry in her brain becomes stronger, the synapses strengthen, the more likely it is that her views on issues will change from progressive to conservative. The result may be a shift within the brain from a person who is partly conservative to a person who is mostly conservative. I believe this has actually happened in many cases. That is the power of the conservative messaging system. It is reflexivity in action. Over time, someone's very personhood can change, and with it her ideal of what other people should be, and of course, who they should vote for. The other conservative use of reflexivity depends on getting those votes. Once in office, conservatives can not only say that government cannot work and has to be minimized and privatized, but by being in the government, they can also stop it from working, thus creating a self-fulfilling prophecy. How? By cutting taxes, by cutting funding, by passing laws, and in the Supreme Court, by reinterpreting laws. In contemporary America, politics and personhood are inseparable, and apparently moving in a conservative direction. To change that direction, progressives need to understand the role of the brain and of communication systems in the process. Politics and personhood at the founding. When the United States was founded, politics and personhood had come together, but in the progressive direction. Historian Lynn Hunt at UCLA goes through the history in detail in her book, Inventing Human Rights, A History. She starts with the defining passage of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If these rights are self-evident, she asks, why does Jefferson have to say that they are self-evident? And when did they become self-evident? Hunt, a former president of the American Historical Society, studied the writing and culture of France, England, and the 13 colonies. She shows that those ideas were not there in the 1600s and came into existence in the mid-1700s, mainly after 1760. When Western Europe and the States were swept up in a major cultural change. That change can be seen in the period's novels like Jean-Jacques Rousseau's Julie, the biggest bestseller of the century with 70 editions between 1761 and 1800. Julie was written as a collection of intimate letters between two lovers. Readers identified deeply with the emotional lives of the characters, whose psychological states were revealed and developed from letter to letter, arousing empathy for the plights of ordinary people. Between 1760 and the 1780s, such novels multiplied. Laws were passed ending torture by the state as being inhuman. Portraits showing the individual characteristics of their subjects started to be painted. Manners changed to increase personal control over one's body. For example, blowing your nose into a handkerchief, and the idea of individual autonomy came into existence in a rush. These changes were propelled by empathy, by identification with the problems and plights of ordinary people, feeling what the characters felt, seeing such plight around them, and propelling legal and governmental change. By 1776, human rights became self-evident via the development of empathy for one's fellow citizens. Such empathy formed the basis for a union of states, the American democracy. Historian Danielle Allen of the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton has taken the study of the Declaration of Independence one important step further in Our Declaration, a reading of the Declaration of Independence in defense of equality. It is a thorough reading of the Declaration, though the central passage again is the classic one on self-evident truths. But Allen, going through the original copies, argues that the period at the end of that passage was not there in the original document. It was inserted later. Her case is backed up by the grammar of what follows. Here is the passage as a whole with the original punctuation. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." Allen argues that with the period, the self-evident truths end with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, what I've described above as coming from the well-being system, but lacking the idea of citizens establishing and working through a government on the basis of empathy and for the well-being of all. The passage ending with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is about freedom, but what follows is about equality, with the central role of the government to secure it. The grammar, the succession of that clauses and the plural, to affect their safety and happiness, shows that the passage goes beyond the pursuit of happiness to the role of government in guaranteeing equality in the unalienable rights. Allen is right that this is a big deal. Her point is not just about a period. It is about our political division. As I describe in my book, Whose Freedom?, progressives and conservatives have very different views of freedom. Conservatives talk about their version of freedom, which does not include either equality or the role of government in securing it. They also attribute their view to the Founding Fathers. And though conservatives seek radical change, they use the term conservative as if it conserved the values of the founding of our nation. At issue is what freedom is supposed to mean, what democracy is supposed to mean, and what personhood is supposed to be. Chapter 6. The private depends on the public. From the beginning, America provided public education, public hospitals, public roads and bridges, an army to protect the Union, a legislature to make laws regulating and maintaining the Union, an executive to carry out those laws, a justice system to enforce those laws, a national bank, a patent office, means to promote interstate commerce, and above all, a system for the public to choose those who govern them. Without such public resources, there could have been no satisfactory private life and no functioning business community in America, and no democracy. This tells us something deep and crucial about American democracy and Western democracy in general. American democracy has grown out of the idea of a union, a coming together of citizens who care about each other and therefore care about their nation as a whole. America has worked as a democracy because enough Americans have taken responsibility for each other, that is, for the nation, using their government to provide public resources for all, enough and of the right kind to provide decent private lives for most of our citizens. Understanding this requires noticing and appreciating those public resources, appreciating the civil servants who provide them, and understanding that we as citizens take on the responsibility through paying for them and providing political support. It is even more true today that the private depends on the public. We, as citizens working through our government, have provided much more. An electric grid, public universities, an interstate highway system, publicly funded scientific research that has resulted in the field of computer science and all computer technology, satellite communications that make telecommunications and the internet possible, modern medicine, airports and an air traffic control system, pilot training through the Air Force, a Center for Disease Control and a Food and Drug Administration, an Environmental Protection Agency, a National Park and National Monument System, a Public Resource Management System, a Civil Service to replace the corrupt old spoils system, and on and on. And perhaps the greatest public resource of all is a public system for managing and guaranteeing the functioning of all these public resources. A government, a system of governing up to these tasks. Without all of this, the blessings of modern American private life and private enterprise would not be here. The private depends on the public. Public resources make private life possible. It doesn't take much to see this. The evidence is all around us every day. There used to be signs on public projects, "Your tax money at work." But such signs appear no more, and the most basic truth of our democracy goes largely unspoken. Why? Progressives take it for granted as part of their moral and practical assumptions, like breathing or noting that the sky is blue. This is an important fact about how brains work. Some ideas and some knowledge are so deep that they rarely, if ever, even come to consciousness. Nobody goes around saying things like, "People breathe," or "You have a nose." But for conservatives, the very idea that the private depends on the public is anathema, immoral. Conservatives have a different view of responsibility. Whereas progressives believe centrally in empathy, caring about their fellow citizens, both personal and social responsibility, and a commitment toward doing their best toward those ends, conservatives believe only in personal responsibility. This yields a completely different view of democracy, that democracy provides what they call liberty, the ability to seek one's own interests without the responsibility of others to help them, without any responsibility to help their fellow citizens, and without interference from the government. This is a moral conviction, as deep in the conservative brain as the progressive's moral vision is in the progressive brain. Again, I say brain, not psyche or mind, for a deep and vital reason. All thought is physical, carried out by the neural circuitry in one's brain. Thoughts don't just float in air. As a result, you can only understand what your existing brain circuitry allows you to understand. The fundamental frames through which you understand the world are physical. Your moral identity is as much a physical part of you as your lungs or your nose. You can only make sense of what your brain allows. If the facts don't fit what your brain physically allows, the brain circuitry stays and facts are either ignored, dismissed, ridiculed, or seen as a form of immorality to be fought against. It is a fact that the private depends on the public, perhaps the most central fact of American democracy, and yet strict conservatives either can't see it or see it as a form of immorality so fundamental that it must be defeated at all costs. This is a major part of what is driving the divisiveness of our country and the conservatives' move to make our government dysfunctional. It is behind the conservative moves to privatize as much of government as possible, to privatize education, public health, public safety, water resources, regulation of business practices, much of national defense, and on and on. Can brains change? Can the brains of enough Americans change so that this basic fact of our democracy can be comprehended and appreciated? In many cases, no. But in the overwhelming majority of cases, yes. What makes it possible is biconceptualism. The brain and constant public discourse. Biconceptualism is a fact about the brain. A great many people have in their brains versions of both progressive and conservative moral values in all sorts of combinations. And they apply these different moral values to different issues. Remember that there is no ideology of the moderate, no set of views held by all moderates. A moderate progressive has mostly progressive views, but also some conservative ones. A moderate conservative has mostly conservative views, but also some progressive ones. But there is no single set of policies that defines a middle. Progressive and conservative worldviews contradict each other. Both are characterized in the brain via neural circuitry. How can you have contradictory neural circuits in the same brain? Easy. The answer is mutual inhibition, a very common kind of brain circuitry. When one circuit is active, it turns off the other. Which is turned on at a given time is a matter of context. Someone with both worldviews applies them to different issues in different contexts, resulting in the brain circuits for the different values unconsciously and automatically switching back and forth depending on the issue. That's what it means to be a biconceptual. It is often these biconceptuals who, as voters, are the target of intense campaign attention. But Republicans understand how to appeal to them better than Democrats do. Recall that all politics is moral and that a voter's implicit sense of morality is absolutely central to a voter's identity. Since biconceptual voters have both moral systems, mostly one but partly the other, conservatives need to keep their voters and attract the partly conservative moderate Democrats. Conversely, progressives need to keep their voters and attract partly progressive moderate Republicans. There is an honest strategy for achieving this goal, and also an Orwellian one. The honest strategy is to use only your language and avoid using the other side's language. That will maximally activate your moral system in the moderates on the other side. The Orwellian strategy involves using the other side's language in an attempt to reach those with moderate or opposing views. But if you use Orwellian language, you will be activating the other side's moral system, making it stronger and shooting yourself in the foot. However, some political organizations use Orwellian language. For instance, an hour before writing this, I received a robocall from the Center for Worker Freedom asking me to support a measure that they said would support worker freedom. They are an anti-union organization, and the measure is anti-union, though the telephone message didn't mention that. They were trying to fool Democrats into supporting an anti-union measure out of ignorance. It is vital that progressives understand why just citing the facts doesn't work, and why attention to public discourse must be constant, not just focused on elections. Here are the basics that progressives need to understand. There is a crucial logic to the way the brain works with respect to public discourse. Here are 10 key points to that logic. 1. The more a brain circuit is activated, the stronger its synapses get. 2. The stronger its synapses get, the more likely it is to fire and the stronger the firing is. 3. When two circuits inhibit each other, the stronger one circuit gets, the weaker the other gets. 4. Suppose two mutually inhibitory circuits apply to different issues. As one gets stronger and the other gets weaker, the more likely it is the stronger one will start applying to more issues and the weaker one to fewer issues. 5. Language changes the strength of those circuits. Conservative language activates circuitry for the conservative worldview. Progressive language activates circuitry for the progressive worldview. 6. Imagery fitting one worldview or the other matters as much or more. 7. Frequency of language use and imagery matters. The more frequent the language use or imagery, the more strengthening occurs. 8. Journalists are trained to use the most frequent language in public discourse. 9. The conservative turn in America has come from the constant use of conservative language in public discourse, so much so that progressives have often adopted conservative language, thus helping the conservative cause. 10. Because of the effect of language and imagery on the brain, the constant use of one ideology's language over the others has an enormous effect on our politics. Conservatives have been doing a better job at getting their language into public discourse. The enormous conservative communication system has done its job well, especially on the central issue of our democracy, that the private depends on the public. The central conservative strategy to minimize or even eliminate public resources has been to eliminate the money that funds public resources, taxes. Taxes for the wealthy have been cut by conservatives, who have defended huge tax loopholes, and have even drastically cut funding for the IRS so that there are not enough IRS workers or modern computers for the IRS to monitor tax evasion, mostly by the wealthy. Since the 1970s, the concept of taxation has shifted from the source of needed and often revered public resources to the idea that taxation is a burden, an affliction in need of tax relief. The constant talk of taxation as an affliction and a burden has led by conceptuals to switch to viewing taxation as a burden rather than something that makes our private lives possible, or that creates a base from which corporations prosper. While conservatives drive these frames home, progressives don't realize that they have to drive their own frames home, and only later realize that the conversation has completely changed. Suddenly, not just conservatives are talking about the burden of taxes instead of the value of public services, but so are the media. So are moderates, and eventually the tax relief language works its way into even progressive discourse. The term Tea Party was chosen to make it sound patriotic to oppose taxation. The only progressive who has succeeded in getting across the idea that the private depends on the public is Elizabeth Warren, who has argued it repeatedly, and did so with special success when she was running for the Senate in 2012. At one point in his presidential campaign, President Obama tried the argument but messed it up when he tried ad-libbing in a public talk and said, "If you've got a business, you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen." Conservatives jumped on his remark and attacked him viciously for it. He could have fixed it by making the point correctly the very next day and every day thereafter, getting the idea out into public discourse and allowing the press to do its job and present the overwhelming evidence for it. But the president was too timid and dropped it, missing a major opportunity to change public discourse. Can progressives turn this around? Yes, but not without serious conscious commitment. The president and every progressive candidate, office holder, and public figure of any kind can start now. Say it right, over and over. Connect the private depends on the public concept to something that conservatives will understand. Freedom. Public resources allow for freedom in case after case, opening up all kinds of opportunities in life. It is the freedom that public resources afford that makes them central to democracy. Saying it right and saying it over and over is advice that can be applied to issue after issue. Part 3. Framing for Specific Issues. Chapter 7. Freedom Issues. One of the major mistakes made by the Democratic Party is to focus on election campaigns but not on the constant framing of public discourse. All politics is moral. Voters vote on what they implicitly, automatically, and unconsciously believe to be right. In short, elections have everything to do with how biconceptuals have adopted the moral vision of one side or the other. And elections depend on the language voters hear and the images they see every day, not just during the campaigns. Democrats tend to address interests. Kitchen table economics and the objective facts affecting the interests of middle class and poor voters. Yet poor conservatives and biconceptuals regularly vote against their interests. Many Tea Party voters are poor or made poorer by conservative policies. But the conservative message machine is relentless and extends almost everywhere. Conservative messaging dominates everyday public discourse. And the domination of everyday public discourse, at least as much as the domination of electoral discourse, determines our political realities. Conservatives have come to own the words freedom and liberty. These words weigh heavily in the conservative vocabulary. These words are among the most powerful in our politics because the centrality of the concept of freedom to democracy. Conservatives have no right to that ownership. Words have contestable meanings, and the word freedom means very different things to progressives than to conservatives. As I pointed out in Whose Freedom? Freedom is a contested concept.